here in the last few years, we've definitely seen an increase in distribution of the otters are more commonly seen in Sumner Straits.
Southeast Alaska sea otters appear to be making a comeback. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 12th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, struggling to treat addiction in Anchorage.
As it stands, we're not going to do any more admits until we get below 85.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
A Juneau man whose boat sank in Sitka Sound over the weekend is recovering in an Anchorage hospital. 68-year-old Lyle Martin was piloting the 36-foot fishing vessel Rascal when it hit a rock near St. Lazaria Island on Saturday. Coast Guard Petty Officer Charlie Hengen says Martin radioed for assistance about 8:30 p.m. He got help from another boater until the Coast Guard rescue diver arrived.
During that time, the Good Samaritan that was in the vicinity was able to locate him and hold him to the side of the vessel, and the H-50 helicopter from Sitka was able to get to the scene in approximately 35 minutes and able to hoist him. He was received by emergency medical personnel there waiting for him. They transferred him to Mount Edgecombe Hospital, and then he was later on transferred to Anchorage.
Hengen says Martin remains in the hospital and is in stable condition. She says he was the only person on board. The Coast Guard says about 450 gallons of fuel were on board when the boat sank, and staff flying over the scene reported a 500-yard by 2-mile oil sheen on Sunday. The Coast Guard's Latasha McQueen says that dissipated by today.
We've had pretty substantial seas, between 7 to 11-foot seas in the evenings, and pretty high winds, and because diesel is one of the lighter fuels, the wave action causes it to disperse into the water column, and the winds help to evaporate the diesel fuel.
St. Lazaria Island is about 15 miles west of Sitka. It's part of the Alaska Maritime National Wildlife Refuge and is known for its seabird population. Refuge officials could not be reached for immediate comment. Sarah Moore of the State Department of Environmental Conservation says the oil did not reach the steep cliffed island's nesting grounds, but it did affect a few birds. The sunken boat is in about 130 feet of water, and salvage is unlikely. In Anchorage, use of an insidious drug is on the rise, while treatment programs for addicts are squeezed for funds to treat clients. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, a narcotic treatment clinic in the state's largest city is facing difficulty in handling an increased caseload, while clients seeking help may be forced to wait months for treatment.
It has many names: Smack, Horse, China White, but they all mean the same thing. Heroin, the drug, is a derivative of morphine, which is made from the seed pods of the Asian poppy. The fact is, heroin use has increased in Anchorage during the past 7 or 8 years. The amount of heroin seized by law enforcement in Anchorage doubled between 2004 and 2006, doubled again in 2007, and quadrupled by last year. Ron Green, clinical director of the Narcotic Drug Treatment Center in Anchorage, says he's seeing more and more young heroin addicts come in.
Yeah, I think our average age here, I think if you average it out, it would probably come around 22 years old, 22 to 24 years of age. Young, white, mostly females, a lot of pregnant females, but people that had jobs or were in school or, you know, were just getting out of school and got addicted to some sort of medication initially.
Close to 5,000 grams of heroin were seized last year in Anchorage, up from 113 grams in 2004. Those staggering statistics are provided by the State Department of Health and Social Services. Vicki Wells, a specialist with the State Division of Behavioral Health, says heroin is replacing prescription opiates like OxyContin as the drug abuser's drug of choice. And many heroin addicts are pregnant women who, by law, must have priority when it comes to treatment.
For the safety of the patient and her fetus. When you withdraw a pregnant woman, you put her fetus at risk. And if she continues to use illicit substances, that also places her fetus at risk. And so for the health of the woman and the fetus, what we want to do is to provide medication-assisted treatment to stabilize and start to focus on good prenatal care and basic things that we all need to live.
Methadone, a synthetic opiate, is used in the treatment of addicts under medical supervision, but Wells says the center provides much more.
It's like a three-legged stool. Methadone is only one part of their therapy. And so they have to be attending individual sessions, group sessions, psychoeducational groups, learning about more about their disease and also about how they can arrest it and stop using. And so family counseling is always a part of that.
The clinic charges on a sliding scale, but Wells says most who seek treatment are at a low point in their lives and have little money to pay anything. She says no one is turned away because of inability to pay. But earlier this month, the treatment center in Anchorage made headlines by turning away pregnant women from the clinic because, Green said, so many pregnant women were applying for help that those on a long waiting list for treatment at the clinic were pushed to the back of the line.
I would say in the last 5 years, we've probably treated between 75 and 100 pregnant women here. So we're getting six a quarter. Every 90 days, six pregnant women show up at our door requesting services. So they have overwhelmed the system.
The center is funded to treat 75 clients. Green says as of today, there are 85 addicts in methadone treatment at the center. When that number drops, he says the center will accept more clients. Until then, people who want treatment will just have to wait. Green says that could be 2 months to a year.
You know, our wait list have been up to 40 at times. So people have waited 6, 8, 9 months to get on the program. And I don't think that's adequate for people to have to wait 9 months suffering with an opiate addiction on a wait list.
Representative Les Guerra and Senator Johnny Ellis have been trying to get more money for the clinic. Guerra says the legislature is not doing a good job.
A heroin addict is committing a felony every day they go out and buy drugs. And when you as a state say, it's okay for us to not treat your heroin addiction, we know you're going to go out and feed the drug dealer's profits. We know you're going to endanger the community by making the drug dealer more powerful. It's bad public policy.
Guerra made a pitch to the House Finance Committee recently, but was blocked by resistance from legislators on the committee. He says not helping people kick their addictions will only cost the state down the road in foster care, incarcerations, and increased social problems. Guerra says he'll keep trying to get more funding for the drug treatment center, but help may come too late for those still on the year-long wait list. Green says there are so many people waiting for treatment that many men users are not going to make the list in the first place. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a debate over Tanner Crab bycatch numbers.
If, you know, you had a large toe that had that level of discard, well, you wouldn't end up with a commercially viable toe. I mean, you'd go broke if you had those kind of toes.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly, giving voice to Alaska business. Litsite Alaska is a web community for families, teachers, librarians, health professionals, and Alaskans of all ages. There are thousands of pages with everything from Alaska's digital archives to kids' games, information about the state's history, culture, narrative, and healing. Teachers love Litsite Alaska. You can discover Litsite Alaska at LITSITE.org. Litsite Alaska is a project of the University of Alaska Anchorage. This message sponsored by UAA.
President Barack Obama is inviting Native American and Alaska Native leaders to meet with him in Washington next month. The White House announced today it will host a Tribal Nations Conference on November 5th. Leaders from each of the 564 federally recognized tribes will be invited to meet with the president and high-ranking members of his administration. In a White House statement, President Obama says he looks forward to hearing directly from leaders in Indian Country about what his administration can do, quote, not only to meet their needs, but help improve their lives and the lives of their peoples. Mr. Obama said the conference will serve as part of the ongoing and important consultation process and further strengthen the nation-to-nation relationship. The president of the National Congress of American Indians, Joe Garcia, responded today by saying, Indian Country has been waiting for well over a decade for a meeting of this caliber with the president of the United States. The White House first mentioned it in June, that it intended to hold a Tribal Nations Conference this fall. Administration officials introduced the idea of the conference when President Obama appointed a first-ever senior policy advisor for Native American Affairs. Kimberly Teehee will be instrumental in next month's meeting. She has not made herself available for an interview with APRN regarding her new position, despite months of requests. Commercial dive fishermen and crabbers in southeast Alaska are worried about losing crab, urchins, sea cucumbers, and clams to what may be an expanding population of sea otters in the region. The Alaska Sea Grant Program has now agreed to fund a new study of sea otters' impact on commercial seafood species. From member station KFSK in Petersburg, Joe Vicnicki reports.
The most recent estimates put otter numbers at around 9,000 animals for the entire region. University of Alaska Fairbanks graduate student and former fish and game dive biologist Zach Hoyt says information on the otter population is sparse and dated.
The area that we're looking at, southern southeast, was completed in 2003. At that point, they estimated in southern southeast that there were just under 6,000 sea otters. I think, again, anecdotally, a lot of folks feel that there's quite a few more otters in this area now, and I wouldn't be surprised if we have a pretty large increase from our population estimate.
Hoyt has successfully landed funding to study otters through the Alaska Sea Grant Program, and he'll be starting up a two-year project along with Marine Advisory Agent Sonny Rice and Ginny Eckert, Associate Professor with the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Hoyt says the first part of that study will be an aerial survey for an updated population estimate.
And we're looking just in southern southeast. We had to limit our study site. But in southern southeast, one of the things that we'll be able to do is have a population estimate. We'll have an estimate of how many otters there are and where those otters are distributed. That's sort of the first step in that aerial survey effort. Summer of 2010.
Southeast's sea otters were hunted to near extinction for their fur in the 18th and 19th centuries. They were protected by international treaty in 1911, but no known colonies remained in the region. That was until the 1960s when Fish and Game transplanted otters from Amchitka Island and Prince William Sound and reintroduced the species to Southeast. Their numbers have rebounded since then, and otters have been reported in Glacier Bay and along the outside coast, including Icy Strait north and south of Sitka, as well as Kyu and Prince of Wales Island to the south. Hoyt says otters are now also reported on the inside waters of Southeast.
Here in the last few years, we've definitely seen an increase in distribution of the population. We're seeing otters are more commonly seen in Sumner Straits, inside waters of sort of Kiku Straits, Cake area, as well as the bays on Southern Admiralty, and then even occasional sightings near Petersburg.
Otters may just be returning to the Inside Passage. Archaeological sites with sea otter remains have been found on Admiralty Island and Port Hooton north of Petersburg. That may indicate past populations of the animals on the inside waters. The second part of the project will be an outreach to communities in southern Southeast to present findings from next year's population survey and gather input from Southeast residents. The Marine Advisory's Sonny Rice will be heading up that part of the project.
This is a great project in my mind because it's not only does it answer a very important and timely issue for the general public, but also we're planning to have structured from the very beginning ways to get input from those users and stakeholders to help us design the project as it moves along.
Rice says she'll be presenting findings in Craig, Petersburg, Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Cake in the fall of 2010. The third part of the project will be a study of sea otter diet. Hoyt says he'll be looking at predation rate on urchins, sea cucumbers, Guida clams, and Dungeness crab.
As otters move into a new area, they're usually feeding on sort of the easiest calories there are in an area, and those are usually things like abalone, urchins, Dungeness crab. And as they go through and deplete those resources, their diet will change to sort of the more mainstays, and those will be clams or mussels and whatnot.
Hoyt says the project will not be coming up with policy recommendations for Southeast's otter populations, but will compile data that policymakers later can use in making future decisions. In Petersburg, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Last week, critical habitat was designated for the southwestern population of sea otters. This designation was required under the Endangered Species Act because Alaska's southwestern population is considered threatened. Their population declined from 100,000 in the 1970s to less than 40,000 now. In the Aleutians, the population is less than 10,000. A Kodiak fisherman presented some dramatic photographs last week at the Federal Fisheries meeting in Anchorage of what was described as an extreme bycatch of tanner crab made by a trawler in Kodiak Island waters this summer. From KMXT in Kodiak, Jay Barrett has more.
The photographs, presented during the testimony of Alexis Kwachka before the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, show a trawl net overflowing with tanner crab. They were also emailed around the state by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council. AMCC is not revealing who took the pictures or what boat he was a crewman on, but what is clear is that many tanners should not have been in the net.
Tanner crab are a prohibited species bycatch in the Gulf, and so all tanner crab need to be thrown overboard.
That's Teresa Peterson, a Kodiak fisherman and AMCC coordinator. She said the mortality rate for tanners caught in trawl nets is very high.
The question then is, well, how many of these tanner crab live? And there's been ongoing studies, and they estimate the mortality rate in the Gulf for trawl vessels is 80%, and the mortality rate for pot vessels is 20%. But those figures actually, they seem to fluctuate over the years in different studies.
Bob Kruger is president of the Alaska Whitefish Trawlers Association and skipper of the Kodiak fishing boat Mar del Norte. He disputes the authenticity of the AMCC photographs.
We believe that there's a very high probability that those pictures were taken on a survey vessel while they were conducting a trawl survey of the crab stocks. I mean, we really have no definitive idea one way or the other of when and where that happened.
He said the tanner stocks are increasing in the Gulf of Alaska, which couldn't be happening if trawlers are draking up that many of them on a regular basis.
If in fact it was a representation of an actual tow where they were targeting bottom fish, it reflects a tow that has no commercial value whatsoever. I mean, if, you know, you had a large tow that had that level of discard, well, you wouldn't end up with a commercially viable tow. I mean, you'd go broke if you had those kind of tows.
Peterson says AMCC is trying to shine the light on the need for greater observer coverage on fishing vessels. Currently, boats under a certain size are only required to have observers one-third of their trips, and only when they're participating in federal waters fisheries. She said there are several proposals before the council.
The first alternative, status quo, and the second alternative would be to close areas to, in considering all ground fish types, trawl, pot, and longline fisheries. And then the third is that in order to fish in these areas, the third alternative is that it would require 100% observer coverage on all the same potential selection of ground fish vessels, the trawl, the pot, and the longline.
Kruger said he'd like to see observers on even more boats than just the ground fish fleet.
We would like to see an increase in observer coverage for all gear types, including the pot and the hook and line sectors, and on vessels, any vessel that was large enough to reasonably accommodate an observer. I mean, vessels, you know, down into the maybe 30-foot range. So we would like to see increased observer coverage on all gear types, all vessel sizes, all fisheries.
Peterson says that beyond increased observer coverage, she would like to see the federal fisheries managers implement some stricter conservation measures for tanner crab, such as what the state did in prohibiting directed pot fishing in inner bays. While both Peterson and Kruger agree tanner stocks are rebuilding, Peterson notes that the directed tanner fishery total allowable catch for 2009 is down 100,000 pounds from 2008. I'm Jay Barrett.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. Primera believes the first job of a health plan is to support good health. More information available at primera.com.
A recent study shows unusually warm temperatures in the Arctic and heavy rains in the tropics likely caused a worldwide increase in the greenhouse gas methane. Scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration say methane increased in the last 2 years after a decade of near-zero growth. NOAA research chemist and methane expert Ed Dugokinski says that's significant because methane has far more potential than carbon dioxide to warm the planet.
Methane's a strong greenhouse gas. Its global warming potential over 100 years is 25 times that of CO2.
Dugokinski says the two potentially biggest contributors to methane release are biomass burning and emissions released from wetlands, including thawing permafrost. He says in the tropics, forest burning contributed to more methane, as did increased rain in the Amazon and Indonesia. Dugokinski says higher temperatures in the Arctic in 2007 also boosted methane gas releases, but he says that leveled off in 2008 when Arctic temperatures were more typical and methane levels did not increase.
You might expect that changing climate has the potential to dramatically increase methane and even CO2 emissions from carbon stored in permafrost and hydrates in the Arctic, but this recovery in 2008 at the Arctic sampling site suggests that we've not seen activation of these climate feedbacks yet.
Scientists at the University of Alaska Fairbanks are monitoring the release of methane that comes when permafrost melts or frozen Arctic lakes thaw. They're concerned of a cycle developing. Methane released will add to warming, which will advance thawing and release more methane. Dugokinski says even though 2008 didn't have more Arctic methane released, scientists at NOAA say it is likely to happen.
Eventually, I think there are going to be increased emissions of methane from the Arctic due the release of these huge amounts of carbon that are stored in permafrost. We just don't think we're at that point yet.
Dugokinski says also of concern is the release of methane from gas hydrates in the Arctic. They're crystalline solids made of gas molecules like methane and water molecules. The NOAA researchers have been measuring methane levels since 1983. They take weekly air samples from 46 different locations around the globe. 7 sites are in the Arctic, including 3 in Alaska, in Barrow, Cold Bay, and Shemya Island. The anniversary of an unusual event in the waters near Sitka was commemorated there on Friday. 100 years ago, a Japanese hunting vessel had wandered off course and was about to be captured by American authorities. A relative of the ship's captain was in Sitka on Friday. KCAW's Ed Ronco was there and has the story.
Japanese Zen monk Shoichi Makabe is chanting a prayer at the Kaisei-maru memorial marker near Sealing Cove. As he intones his blessing, Makabe strikes a small chime with a metal rod. Onlookers stand nearby in silence. A few of them have their hands pressed together and their eyes closed. Makabe's great uncle captained the Kaisei-maru, and Makabe makes annual visits to Sitka to see the memorial. On this day, he's here to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the ship's last journey, one that started in Shiogama, Japan, and ended at the bottom of this harbor. The Kaisei-maru was a 68-ton schooner. In 1909, a series of bad storms blew it into Alaskan coastal waters. Witnesses told authorities that they saw crew members poaching fur seals, which led the deputy marshal at the time to take action. Sitka Historical Society director Bob Mettinger picks up the story.
He commandeered a ship, mounted a machine gun on it, took a contingent of 10 to 15 Marines, went out and boarded the Japanese ship, the Kaisei-maru. Shots were not fired, but it was tense.
The crew of 30 was arrested and jailed in Sitka, and then sent to Juneau, and then held there for months. These guys found themselves in the wrong place at exactly the wrong time in history. Not long before, the Japanese had been warring with the Russians. Tensions were mounting around seal hunting rights, and
on the West Coast, this yellow peril, this fear and almost loathing of immigrants from China and Japan, all of that was going on at this period of time, and the newspapers of the time kind of fed this with the initial reports.
After about 4 months, they were tried and acquitted of the poaching charge.
So this jury of 12 white men said not guilty on the poaching charges. They were found guilty on not reporting into the customs agent that they were in American waters, but the testimony also indicated they tried to find out where they were to go, but language difficulties between a Tlingit man and a Japanese man, it just didn't work very well.
So they were deported. But instead of returning to the Kaisei Maru, the men were sent by steamer from Juneau to Seattle, and then to Japan. Mettinger says that's where the story goes from sad to tragic. The Kaisei Maru's captain knew his crew would not be paid, and he knew that he had lost an entire hunting season and that he would have to face the ship's owner and explain the loss. So, one day shy of arrival, he jumped overboard and killed himself. A couple years later, in a bad storm, the Kaisei Maru sank to the bottom of what would become Sealing Cove Harbor. Its wreckage stayed there until 1983, when workers were dredging out that harbor. Archaeologists were called in to look at the wreckage, and now the ship's anchor sits underneath a small shelter right near the memorial marker at the water's edge. The history of this ship isn't really talked about in Japan, Makabe says, because of the captain's suicide. Atsuo Tsudona translates.
He didn't come home, so the family didn't want to speak up in their hometown. That's a reason why the nowadays in Shiogama or the home port of the Ishihama, the people do not bring up this history in the public.
Makabe said he received an artifact from the ship during his visit to Sitka, and he'll bring it back to share it with people in Shiogama. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey and Ed Gronko in Sitka, Joe Vicnicki in Petersburg, and Jay Barrett in Kodiak. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Elks National Foundation, in conjunction with the Alaska State Elks Association and local lodges, is offering the Most Valuable Student MVS Scholarship for high school seniors. These scholarships are awarded to graduating high school seniors through a local, state, and national competition and are based on scholarship, leadership, and financial need. Information and applications at elks.org/ENF. Application deadline is November 2nd. This message sponsored by the Alaska Elks Association. This flu season, every Alaskan should roll up their sleeves and fight the flu by making plans to get both the swine flu and regular seasonal flu vaccines. In the meantime, fight the flu by washing your hands often or using a hand sanitizer, coughing into your sleeve or a tissue, and keeping sick people at home. For more information on how to fight the flu, go to pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.